Hi everyone, and thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lit Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio. My name is Miro, and as always, I will be your host for today's show. We have a special episode on Lit Radio today, as I am joined by two guests, and they are the authors of The Chief Wellbeing Officer, Stephen P. McGregor and Rory Simpson. How are you today, guys?
Great. Lovely to be here, Miro.
Yeah, great. Top quality.
Absolutely, yeah, fantastic to have you on the podcast. And of course, for our audience, Stephen has helped improve the health and well-being of more than 20,000 managers worldwide through his Sustaining Executive Performance Program, and he is also the founder of the Leadership Academy of Barcelona. And Rory is currently the Chief Learning Officer at Telefonica and formerly Associate Dean of the London Business School. So I'm very happy to have you both on the podcast talking today about the book. But before we get into the, I guess, the meat of the content in there, I really want to ask you guys, what inspired you to actually become authors and start writing?
Rory and I have known each other for several years. Actually, beginning when I pitched Rory when he was just a couple of years into his role at Telefonica with the ESA Business School. And then we just started working together after that. And, I think our work always complemented each other. You mentioned the Sustained Executive Performance Program that in many ways really flourished in Telefonica with Rory's support. And Rory's been teaching a very successful Leading Self program there the last several years as well. So those two things fit very well together. We've collaborated in different workshops and teaching both inside and outside Telefonica, and the book just felt like a nice extension to merging the ideas or the very common view of the world and the working world that we both have.
I'd just like to add anecdotally, I knew I had at least one book in me. I've always wanted to write a book. And in fact, my mother is a writer, an author. And a family heirloom is the writing desk of Sir Walter Scott. And she'd always said that her child that writes the first book will get the desk. So I've been sort of waiting to write the book, and the impetus came from Stephen to get going and to put into a book much of the work that we've been doing over the years. So it was the planets were aligned, and the rest is history.
Yeah, and let's talk about the book itself. And what really struck out for me in preparation of the podcast was actually the title, the Chief Wellbeing Officer. What was the reasoning behind something like this? Do you perhaps have a Chief Wellbeing Officer yourselves?
We can look at this different ways. I mean, some people look at the book as if, we're giving guidance on a formal role of a chief wellbeing officer that should be in a company, and that could be the case. But more than that, we were just looking at getting across the message of wellbeing has to be taken more seriously. So what we see in many organizations is that wellbeing exists in a very junior level of the organization, and there's also a very negative view of the importance of well-being. So it's about reducing absenteeism and sickness and things like that. But what we've found in our work, separately and together the last several years, is that there's a real business case for improving leadership, having more human workplace, improving creativity, energy, decision-making, all these different things. So we just wanted to, put well-being into that phrase of chief and officer, just to get across that importance of bringing it further up the agenda, the executive agenda.
It's also become much more immediate. In the past, well-being might have been seen as something like investing in the National Health Service so that people will get less sick or live longer in future years. It's absolutely immediate now. People realize that leadership is about empathy, and empathy and leadership lead in very well to well-being. And as Stephen says, calling it chief wellbeing officer, it puts it at, it gives it immediacy, and it puts it top of the bill.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I was going through the book, I really did get the idea that it is for anyone that wants to create a more human workplace. But it is also a phrase which, as you've mentioned, you know, a lot of companies do try to engage with making their environment more human and more relatable with all the factors you said there. But what is the essence of a human workplace, in your opinion? How do we actually achieve such a state outside of what's the norm?
Let me say, just to contextualize that and completely agree with you, is this idea of being human. I work basically for a tech company. You know, it began as a telco, but telcos have to transform into becoming tech companies or perish. And yet, the more tech that we surround ourselves with, the more we realize the importance of being human. As human, we need to understand the tech. We don't need to become robots, but we need to understand robots. And being human, ironically almost, or paradoxically, is becoming more and more important as we're surrounded by tech. Being human, connecting with oneself, connecting with others, it's more and more important in this digital world. And once again, well-being, you know, strikes a chord at the very heart of that idea of being human.
No, absolutely. And you know, it was a big motivation that we're surrounded by so much commentary on artificial intelligence and the coming of the robots. But what will distinguish the leaders in the future is that can they, you know, be a more human workplace? And in many ways, working it really compromises a lot of our basic human needs. You know, so through in sustained executive performance, we looked at a lot of the physical needs of us all as human beings within the workplace, which are compromised, and we retrace that in one of the chapters in Chief Wellbeing Officer. So even the importance of mobility, you know, pushing back against a sedentary office life, and then getting all the benefits of increased energy and motivation and decision making that you can get from that. So there's a physical aspect in the book about how you can be a more human workplace. There's an emotional part and a mental part in the book about how you can become a more human workplace. And there are also other elements in terms of, you know, finding your passion, aligning with your purpose and values, and reflecting a lot of other, you know, ongoing, you know, commentary in the business world in that domain. So what we've done, or what we try to do, is bring together a lot of the disparate elements that you'll find often in other places. You know, I think we've got unique content in there for sure, but in many ways it's a synthesis of a lot of other things that are going on, and hopefully it'll be of great value for companies going ahead in this very technological-based world.
Yeah, absolutely. And to follow on that, this idea of technology into our lives, I think, has become arguably one of the biggest conversations, not only in business, but in general during our time. And I really want to kind of elaborate on that, because I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to say that technology has essentially morphed into its next stage at this point. You know, what we could do in a, let's say, a mobile device now would be unthinkable, you know, less than 20 years ago. It's absolutely mind-blowing. But do you think, as we've just talked about this, do you think that there is perhaps a fine line where we can lose that sort of human workplace, that human element, and perhaps even a part of ourselves? Is there a way that we can make technology work for us and not the other way around?
Yeah, I would just say absolutely. I mean, it's not that there's a fine line that we might cross. We've crossed that line. We have been losing humanity through technology. We've been losing it for a number of years now, and it's time to get back across that line and realize that technology can help us, but the humanity comes first. All this idea of autonomous vehicles, people in Silicon Valley trying to solve death, things that are going to happen in the next 10 years that we can't even imagine. On the other hand, there's many of things that we have now which our grandparents could never imagine. Everything from fast food, pizza delivery, to, of course, cell phones and the internet. We see this exponential trend that's catapulting us ahead, away across that line. But it's not too late, which is why it's time to embrace in a holistic way this idea of well-being. Well-being way beyond the gym. We're talking about spirituality, emotion, and one's personal moral compass. not the company's moral compass, the individual's moral compass.
Absolutely. You know, you can ask yourself, are you going to be an optimist or a pessimist? In many ways, technology does have the potential to become seamless, to improve our lives. But in many ways, we don't always benefit from an easier life or more convenience. You know, there was a great article in the New York Times, maybe you can add it, Miro, after the interview, on the scourge of convenience, right? You know, supermarkets in the 1950s, you know, made our lives more convenient, but did it make us healthier, you know? So convenience in many ways, or less friction in our lives, isn't always a good thing for our health and well-being. So, you know, there's that side of things. You would hope that, you know, we will come out the other side and technology will make our lives better. But there has to be that input that is the human side of things. And we think well-being will really drive that. And one of the chapters that we have in the book is on design for well-being. And, you know, a lot of attention also in the design thinking term the last couple of years. But design is essentially how you can become more human or solve human needs. And I think if we take the process of design, the methodology, let's say, and we use well-being as one of the principal drivers, then we can design tech that will be really, you know, fit for human purpose, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And going back to the book, what really was very fascinating to me was the actual design of the format, which is, you know, very highly accessible and is very story-driven, but at the same time, it has quite a large number of illustrations and exercises. So how did you guys go about in terms of formulating such an interesting format and, you know, putting it down on paper?
We had a strong vision that was making it appealing. Because we do feel that well-being hasn't been an easy thing to sell, let's say, especially in the rarefied senior levels of business. So we wanted to make it easy to understand, to absorb, to make it visually appealing. And as you say, story-driven. So there's a couple of elements in that, you know. And also the motivation for me personally, you know, I wrote Sustained Executive Performance, which I was happy with, but you know, there was a few comments on people were saying it was a nice message, it was great messages, but, you know, wasn't the easiest to absorb, right? And I just wanted the next one to really hit home a bit clearer. And another couple of elements on the stories, you know, I had been preparing the follow-up to Sustained Executive Performance for about a year and a half. And the interesting thing was that the very first interview that I did for the follow-up was with Rory's dad, Professor Hugh Simpson. And what he worked on in his career was just aligned so well with what we've been doing the last several years. So even bringing back a lot of his own stories from several decades ago, and Rory can then detail these in a minute, and then also science or research and even circadian rhythms, which has been the subject of the Nobel Prize in the last year, was just fascinating. It was such a pleasure to put that in. And then the final element was also the city of Barcelona. So we met here in Barcelona, we both love the city, we both think it has so much potential to offer in terms of well-being, and we're committed to, you know, pursuing our lives and our careers here, at least at the moment. And so that was the motivation also for having, you know, these little vignettes at the beginning and the end of every chapter, which showed Barcelona in its different facets. So we think with all those different elements together, it really does make it appealing and a joy to read as well as being informative.
And I might just add to that that, you know, Stephen and I are teaching executives on a daily basis. Between us, we're probably exposed to about 6,000 executives a year, which means our stories, we're trialing and we're testing on a multicultural platform daily. And so you work out which, not just which stories are you getting a laugh to, but which stories are penetrating, what is the best means to educate, which stories are people most likely to listen to and obviously then to learn from. And a big impetus of the book was getting that stuff down and sharing that with a much wider audience, of course, which will come as the readers to the book.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the large amount of sort of senior level executives that you guys work with. And just to follow up on that, do you think that when it comes to, you know, health, well-being at the workplace, that human aspect, it is something that perhaps the younger generations expect, and is something up to kind of the higher up, the senior executives to deliver? Or do you think that across the board there's been a change of mind recently about the matter?
Look, first of all, everybody's talking about lifelong learning. It's not just a millennial thing. Everybody understands that learning is very akin to a gym membership and being fit and healthy. And then those two paths have met, and then people have realized holistically it's all the same thing, and that's what well-being is. Lifelong learning is something that by definition happens your whole life. And lifelong learning is about reading. It's about having, you know, specific scientific type training about facts and figures and data and strategy, but also less scientific stuff, more orientated towards the humanities. And we really are at a nexus, at a crossing over point in time when people realize these things can't be separated. And that's coming together in terms of this world, this word, well-being.
Look, we've had exposure to different demographics over the years. So you in many cases, you've got a mixed audience of different ages and different generations, let's say. But also we've had focus groups where there's been a real senior audience. And the challenge there is that they're kind of broken already in a way, right? And you need to try and fix them. And for sure, when you get like a high potential or new graduate scheme as an audience, you see the different mindset, right? You know, there's a loosening of the belief that it's about making as much money as you can in a short amount of time and then retiring and putting your feet up and then healing your health and well-being after that because the job has compromised these things. I think they're in it for the long haul. The lifelong learning is Rory talks about, and they want to make an impact. You know, there's more on, more than just a paycheck, about improving the world and things like that, right? So the challenge is different, and I think for the audience that come to the book, it could be the senior level people who actually want to try and fix themselves in a way or design a culture that supports health and well-being for business success. But also for the younger generation, I think there's a lot of appeal there for them in terms of how they can manage upwards, how they can try and proactively shape the culture of enterprise going forward, so it's less about business results at all costs, but health and well-being is very much core to them getting those results.
And within that, you know, it's not just lifelong learning, it's lifelong working. You know, the book is about exemplifying the idea that work and life are synonymous. And this idea of separating your business life from your personal life, well, perhaps if you can align yourself with the right job, maybe you'll want to keep working. Huge amount of stats of people that this idea of saving up for their retirement, then they retire and then they die, because actually somehow they feel that they've lost purpose. But if they can align their purpose with their job, it could be that in some way, and assuming they're not working down a coal mine, in some way they'll want to keep working, not just into their 60s and 70s, but maybe 80s and 90s.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And just the last bit in that, actually, because we have a case study in the book. It's about a company that remains anonymous, but previously they would have relied on their brand luster to attract the brightest and best young talent. And they revolted, right? They didn't accept the onboarding process and they wanted to leave. And these were, you know, the 1% that were selected from about, you know, the many several hundred thousand applicants for this company. And companies, you know, even the Facebooks and the Googles and the McKinseys, they can't rely on automatically just using their brand to attract the best talent. So the talent will go to the places where the environment supports these lifelong goals, which is not just about a paycheck. It's not even just about an impact in the world, but it's about an environment that supports them developing as a human being.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a fantastic message. And to close off, guys, I really want to ask you the question I ask everyone that comes on the podcast. And that's actually, what are you currently reading? Or do you perhaps have any recommendations for our listeners?
So I like to read. I believe that lifelong learning doesn't begin with technology. It begins with books. I am currently reading, or just finished Fahrenheit 451 which is about a sort of dystopian world. Amazing that it's written in the 50s and very relevant for a person working in a company like Telefonica, where it's all about connectivity. I'm reading the Murakami book, What to Talk About When I Talk About Running, which is a great reference to the idea that running is so therapeutic, physically as well as emotionally. I'm also floundering a little bit with Crime and Punishment. I've noticed that an awful lot of modern business books are actually referencing the great Russian writers like Dostoevsky, or more modern writers like Solzhenitsyn. There's always, next to my bed, there's always a pile of sort of business, self-help type books, like Altered Traits, and books that reference the idea of how to get some kind of flow in your life, how to be the best version of yourself. So just to name a few. Stephen?
Yeah. You know, I was a lapsed reader for several years, and I've often talked to Rory about this, and he inspired me just to get moving again. You know, when I did my PhD, I often talk about that's the foie gras method of reading. You're reading so many dull scientific papers that it kind of put me off for a couple of years. But now I seem to have got moving again in the last several months. Again, I've got a couple on the go simultaneously. I like to mix business with other kind of more pleasurable, you know, business books can be good, but they can be very dry. So I kind of try and mix it up a little bit. So I'm reading Hemingway at the moment. Again, A Movable Feast. I'm reading Spark, which is about the neuroscience benefits of exercise, from Dr. John Ratey, who's a noted neuroscientist. I'm reading Better Than Before, which is a book about habits, from Gretchen Rubin. And I'm reading The Heartfulness Way, which is a book on, you know, meditation based on the heart that a colleague introduced me to in India over the summer. And I think they all inform different parts of what I want to improve myself. You know, I think, Rory, with the greatness, you know, we write on well-being and health and work in that area. It doesn't mean that we've got the answers, right? And we have the challenges that many other people in business have. So a lot of these books are to help myself, and also to think about how this can come into the classroom and then inform on ongoing writing.
Great. If I could just add one more, I like to have different books in different rooms in my house, and then maybe sit down and just read, you know, dip in. So in my kind of study, I've got Walter Isaacson's tome on Da Vinci, and I'm using a lot of insights from that to bring into the classroom. And I'm fascinated at the moment. I think it's thinking of the metaphor that can come out of this. The way that when he drew a person, he would first of all draw a skeletal framework of the person. Then he would put on the flesh and draw a nude person. And then he would put on the clothes and dress the person.
Wow.
Which is why you would have such sort of lifelike but deep holistic figures emanating out of the page. I'm trying to build that into some kind of metaphor into my teaching.
Fascinating stuff there. And of course, for our listeners, if all of this sounds interesting to you as well, there'll be links in the description so you can go and you can find out more about those books yourselves and perhaps pick out a few and experience them for yourself. But with that, guys, I'd like to thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast. It's been great having you on.
Pleasure, Miro. Many thanks.
Thank you.
And of course, for our listeners, if you enjoyed our conversation today, please check out the description below where you can find everything about the Chief Wellbeing Officer and, of course, the topics and themes that we discussed today. And I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have a great audience on the podcast. And if you have any feedback for us, please reach out at Lid Radio on all social media channels. And as always, I will very much look forward to seeing you next week.